This Do Lectures episode features founder of Appropriate Response and Zen monistic trained Pam Wise, sharing an incredible introduction to the abundance that comes from her mindfulness training and accessible practices. Recorded live at the global event in California, USA in 2011.
So I am a Buddhist meditation teacher, and I also do work in organizations, working with leaders and doing coaching and organizational transformation. And my real passion is in the intersection, the blending and bringing together of those two parts. And today I want to share a story with you that I have never told before in public. It's a story about listening to the sycamores. This was an experience that I had over 20 years ago now that has stayed with me for all of these years and which has had a very deep impact on me and really influenced how I think about what I do and about work and life. So what do? For the last 7 years, in part with Anna and a group of colleagues, we have been introducing a kind of holistic, a little bit radical, out of the box, mindfulness-based human development program at Genentech, which is a big biotech company in South San Francisco. And over the last 7 years, we've introduced this program, which we call the Personal Excellence Program, or fondly PEP, to about 800 people inside the IT and manufacturing and research department at Genentech. And the way that this came about was in a partnership and collaboration between myself and Todd Pierce, who is the head of the IT shop at Genentech. And Todd had invited me into his organization to teach mindfulness classes, meditation classes. And he was a meditator himself and knew the impact of that practice. And so I was teaching mindfulness classes, and they were going really well. There was kind of a buzz in the organization about that work. And at some point, about 6 or 8 months in, he called me into his office and he said, you know, these mindfulness classes are good, but not everybody in this organization is going to sign up for a mindfulness class. And he said, I want more impact. I want to actually create a culture of mindfulness in my organization. Now, how would you do that? And I said, I don't know. I don't know if anybody's ever done that before. And like a good visionary leader, he said, great, let's make it up. And so we began this 7-year experiment. And I will say that at the beginning, I was a little skeptical, you know? I just didn't know if it was gonna work. I knew as a coach and as a meditation teacher that I could impact one person, but change a culture? I wasn't convinced, I had my doubts. So much to my delight, and in many ways my surprise, I was proven wrong. And the program has in fact been extraordinarily and kind of wildly successful beyond my wildest dreams. And I'll give you some data about that. So when Todd took over the IT department, it was ranked the lowest in employee satisfaction in the whole company. And several years into the initiation of our program, the IT department was ranked the number 2 best place to work in Computer World magazine of 100 IT organizations. So that was a tremendous transformation. And we collect our own data, and we've seen that the people who are in the program, something like 98% of the people say that they, as a result, feel more capable of learning and growing and being responsible for their own development. 88% of the people who go through the program say that they find a greater sense of meaning and satisfaction at work as a result. And we brought in some external consultants to measure kind of the hard line data, you know. And they had studied leadership programs, hundreds of leadership programs, and they said that when they measured ours, that we had 3 times the business impact of hundreds of programs that they had studied. They were wondering, you know, what are you doing? And they said that the return on investment, I don't know exactly how they got this, but the return on investment was that for every dollar spent by the company to invest in the program, there was $1.5 to $2 in return. So this was pretty impressive. But the real impact, of course, that I've seen and my colleagues have seen is not so much in the numbers, but in the lives transformed. And I've seen dozens and dozens of people who have changed their relationship with themselves, with their colleagues, with their boss, with their families, with their loved ones, with their communities. So this is a not an obvious photograph. This is a picture of our logo. So triangle, circle, square, which represents the triangle is a head, circle is a heart, the square is the body. And we talk about developing the whole person, head, heart, and body. So this is a photograph of 200 IT employees on the roof of a parking structure who made themselves into this very large triangle, circle, square. And this photograph was shot by a helicopter, and it was given as a gift from the employees to Todd as appreciation and gratitude for his bringing this program to them. So I am actually not going to talk about the program exactly, but what I want to talk about today and to try to share with you is a little bit of the source of what is it that I think has made this program so successful. And that's a much more personal story. It's a story for me of bridging two worlds. On one hand, the world of doing, the world of the fast-paced, dynamic business workplace. And on the other hand, the world of being, the world of stillness, of quiet, of contemplation, of meditation. So 20 years ago, I was living as a monk at Tassajara Zen Mountain Monastery. So you have to picture me with a buzz cut and wearing long black Japanese draping robes. And Tassajara is the first Buddhist monastery established in the United States, and it's in the Ventana Wilderness area. There's a 14-mile dirt road that it takes to get into Tassajara. It takes an hour to transverse that road. So it's in a very remote setting. And Tassajara is located on natural hot springs. Some of you may be familiar with the Tassajara Bread Book or something like that. So in the summer, it's open for guests who come in to enjoy the hot springs and delicious vegetarian food. And then in the winter months and the fall, the gates close for intensive monastic training. And I lived there in 1989 and 1990, and it was then that I had this experience of listening to the sycamores. And the sycamores are these grand, beautiful trees with this mottled bark and broad, woolly leaves that line the pathways of Tassajara. Before I tell the story, I want to just back up a little bit and share, you know, how is it that an upper middle class Jewish girl ended up in a monastery? There are many answers to that question. When I was younger, when I was still actively engaged living in the Zen Center, people used to ask me, you know, what had called me, what brought me there. And I used to say that it was searching and suffering. And in my history, one of the pivotal events that I think led me to do intensive monastic training was that when I was 10 years old, I was diagnosed with diabetes. So I've lived for almost 40 years now with a chronic illness, which means my body doesn't produce insulin and I have to take it manually. And when I was young, I remember people used to always say, God, isn't it terrible to have to give yourself shots? And for me, giving myself shots, or more commonly now, people wear an insulin pump, that's not the hard part. What was hard for me at that young age in particular was that early diagnosis set up a relationship for me between myself and my body that was fraught. It was, in many ways, a kind of battlefield. And it set up a relationship between me and it. So diabetes is a disease in which my body doesn't maintain its own homeostasis. And so it requires a certain kind of vigilance and attentiveness. And over the years, I went to all different kinds of doctors and nurses and nutritionists. I saw acupuncturists and homeopathists and energy healers and body workers and shamans, and always looking, searching, trying to somehow heal myself, to somehow find a way to fix what felt like a mistake, you know, a problem that I was living with. So one time I went and visited this Tibetan doctor, and it was an amazing experience and really a turning point in my life. And I went in, it was this sort of small, sweet-looking man, and he looked in my eyes, and he looked at my tongue, and he pressed on my fingernails. And then he sat down across from me, and he just gazed at me for a while. And then he began to speak, and he spoke through a translator, and he said to me, "The most important thing for you," and he stopped, and he said, "The single most important thing for you to do," and I was like, "Yeah, you got me, you know, I'm sitting on the edge of my seat waiting, tell me, please." And then he said, "is to love yourself completely." And I was so confused. You know, I felt sort of disoriented, really, and a little disappointed. I think I had hoped he would say something like, "Could you just eat more broccoli?" You know? And I think it was in that moment that I recognized two things. The first was that the healing that I was seeking was not physical. It was spiritual. And the other thing that I recognized was that I had no idea how to do what he was suggesting. And in many ways, it was that that took me into living in the monastic setting and practicing Zen. So this is, flash forward, the meditation hall at Tassajara. And in monastic life, you spend most of the day in the meditation hall. It's a long day, and the day is spent primarily in long, silent hours of upright sitting. This is not the hall at Tassajara. You can't take pictures there. So these are Japanese Zen monks. But it looks like that. That's bald head, black robes. And one of the things about monastic life is this profound stillness and silence. And Tassajara has limited electricity. And so the pathways, these paths that are lined with these sycamore trees, and the cabins are lit with kerosene lamps. And so at night when you go to sleep, the first sound that you hear in the morning is someone who's running, literally, running through the main path in Tassajara, ringing a wake-up bell, clang, 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 clang. So out of the silence comes the sound of this bell. And the second sound that you hear is the sound of the han. A han is a Japanese wooden block. And it's used as a summons to call monks to meditation. And on the face of the han is this beautiful poem. This is a slightly different version that you see there. But the poem says, "Great is the matter of birth and death. Time passes quickly and swiftly is lost. Awaken, awaken. Do not waste your life." So it's with these words that the monks are called to come and sit, to meditate and wake up. And in the background of all of this sound, so there's this amazing interplay of silence and sound, these instruments, the bell, the han, there's a drum. In the background is the sound of Tassajara Creek. And this is the actual picture of the creek that flows alongside the meditation hall. So the story of the sycamores is that one morning I was sitting, and again, I can't take pictures in the meditation hall, so this is symbol of a woman sitting. So I was sitting in the dark, the still, the quiet morning, and I noticed something. And I noticed that the sound of the creek had changed pretty significantly. Overnight it had shifted. The day before it had been shh, and then the next morning, and I thought, what happened? You know, there hadn't been any rain. There was no obvious reason that the sound of the creek would have shifted in this way. So in the afternoon, I asked one of the old timers at Tassajara, and he said, oh, it's the sycamores. It's the sycamores? And he said, yes, they've dropped their water. I said, the sycamores dropped their water? He said, yes, you watch. Tomorrow, the leaves will begin to turn and fall. And amazingly, just as he suggested, the very next day, the leaves of the trees all through Tassajara began to turn. And by the end of the week, the paths were blanketed with this incredibly beautiful tapestry of color and crunch. So all of these years, this memory has stayed with me. And for me, that whole story evoked, there was this sense of wonder, really, of amazement. And I thought at the time, how did they know? Right? How did all those trees know to drop their water at the same time? Because it happened so fast and so in such a coordinated way. And I thought, did they have some kind of secret language, you know, that they were speaking? Or did somebody wave a magic wand out there and say, okay, everybody, one, two, three, drop, you know? And I didn't understand it, but it touched something. And in preparing for this talk, I did some research, and I found out that there is, in fact, a scientific explanation, which is that as the Earth turns on its axis, the slant of light changes, the angle of light changes, and temperature changes. And what happens is that it signals to the trees to seal off the place where the leaf connects to the branch. And when that sealing off happens with the light and temperature change, the water stops flowing to the leaves. And it begins to build up in the trunk of the tree. And when the water builds to a certain point in the trunk, the trees drop their water. And it goes into the water table, and then it causes the sound of the creek to increase. Amazing. But I found that when I read even this scientific explanation, which is accurate and true, that it also missed something. You know, it missed, there was still this sense of mystery and wonder that I had felt. And I think that part of the reason that that explanation is not sufficient is that this story points to a deeper truth. It points to a truth that when we're quiet enough to really listen, that we know this in our bones, but we're often moving so fast, we're doing so much, that we can miss it. And that's the truth of our deep connectedness. It's the truth that we know that we are part of this shimmering web of being that connects the trees to each other and to the earth and to the creek, and that connects all of us to the trees and to the earth and to one another. And I think as I was reflecting on the success of our program that in a way, what we've been doing is very, very simple, which is that we have been teaching people to listen. And when I say listening, I don't mean hearing, and I don't mean listening as technique, right? So there's a way you make eye contact and you ask open-ended questions and you reflect. I don't mean that kind of listening. I mean listening that is this profound capacity to pay attention, to really be awake and present for each moment of our life and our experience. And that when we learn to pay attention in this way, we discover for ourselves the truth of this deep connectedness, and that in itself is a kind of healing. So I want to share a story about listening. This is a story of George Washington Carver. Some of you may know his story. He was a botanist, a scientist, and kind of a social revolutionary. He's most well known for inventing over 300 uses for the peanut. But really, George Washington Carver, who was born in the 1860s in Missouri to slave parents, and it was his passion, his love for the natural world that caused him to create inventions and ideas that transformed Southern agriculture and really changed the lives of many poor black farmers at the time. And when George was a little boy, he was born a sickly child, and he wasn't able to work in the fields. And he was nicknamed the Little Plant Doctor. It's actually a book I found online about George Washington Carver. And he had this amazing green thumb. And all of the women in the communities would, in his community, would bring him their ailing houseplants. And George, he had a little plant hospital in the woods, and he would heal their plants. It was, you know, kind of a phenomena. So one day, one of these women came to little George, and she came to retrieve her now thriving houseplant. And she looked at him and said, you know, what is your secret? How do you do this? How is it that you're able to heal all these plants? And George, perhaps with a wisdom greater than his years, he looked at her and said, if you listen to things and love them, if you listen to things and love them, they will reveal themselves to you. If we listen to things and love them, they will reveal themselves to us. When we take the time to listen in this way, to really pay attention to ourselves, to other people, to the world itself will reveal itself in its tremendous aliveness and mystery and beauty. So I want to share with you in closing one of the practices that we do. This is, you'll recognize this head, heart, body, this triangle, circle, square from the beginning photograph on the rooftop. And this is this what we call a three-center check-in. This is the business version of listening and loving. So we don't call it mindfulness, and we don't call it listening and loving, but three-center check-in is kind of benign enough that everyone thinks, okay, I'll do that. Right? It's true. And this is a practice that we introduce as a kind of a foundation in our program and that people pick up and use for themselves. And then within the organization, it's now used at the beginning of meetings, in all kinds of processes. It's really been a remarkable thing to watch this go. So I want to invite us all to practice this together. So if you will indulge me and close your eyes for a moment and find a way to sit as comfortably as you can in not very comfortable chairs. And just feel your body pressing into the chair for a moment, or the floor, wherever you're seated. And maybe take a deep, full breath. And then I would invite you to turn your attention inward, first to the head center, to the thinking center, and to listen in, to notice, without judging, without needing to change your experience in any way, just tuning in and listening, noticing, what are you aware of in your mind? Are there thoughts or images? Maybe there's a running commentary, or perhaps planning, or worrying, or wondering. Just opening and receiving whatever's there, just as it is, now. And then letting your attention drop and move from the head down into the heart center, in the center of the chest. And tuning in once again to the heart, which is the feeling center, to notice, what am I feeling? What is my mood or emotional tone or attitude as I sit here now? Maybe there is frustration or contentment. maybe anxiety or delight. Again, no need to change, no need to judge, just opening, receiving, allowing your experience just as it is. And finally, allowing your attention to drop further still down into the belly center and into the whole body, imagining you could fill your entire body with your intention. And noticing now, as you tune in, as you listen in to the body, what are you aware of? Are there places in the body that feel tight or contracted? Maybe the body feels warm or cool. What's the energy of the body like? Does the body feel heavy and dense, or spacious and light? Just opening to receive the body expressing itself just as it is now. And in a moment, I'm going to ring a bell, and I invite you to keep your eyes closed and to use the bell as a way to listen. Listening to how the sound of the bell arises up magically out of silence, and it abides for a time and then will fade away. And seeing, can you stay with that sound right to the very end? Noticing that very moment when the sound dissolves back into silence. And as you're ready, you can open your eyes and come back into the room. Thank you very much. I will just say, sorry, it's a premature thank you. Just to say in closing that I think in a way my little do is this practice of helping to teach people to listen and love. And the big do, I would say, is that recognition that when we are willing to tune in and listen to ourselves in this way, which sometimes can feel self-centered or like, what's the point? I'm too busy to do this. That in fact, when we do it, that because of the truth of this web of connection, the truth of our deep connectedness, when we listen in this way, it has an impact. And that impact moves out into the world in ever widening circles, touching the lives of our friends, our families, our loved ones, and that this is the way we change the world. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or, if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out. For our weekly curation of wonder and optimism, sign up to our newsletter by visiting thedolectures.com/newsletter.